Blog Talk Radio. Yes, we are. What, a week or two away?
Far away not at all now.
And so we're glad you could join us tonight, where we have our returning consultant, David Roundtree, going to join us. And if you have questions, we'd love to hear them in the chat room, or if you'd like to call in, you can do that. The number's on your screen there. And, of course, we have John Rossi screening calls tonight. And so you'll get to talk with John first, and then you can talk to us. And I don't know which is best, but...
Yeah, what more could anybody ask for?
I know, yeah. So like, you know, we've done it all now.
Absolutely.
So, anyway, tonight, David Roundtree, Paranexus consultant, author, researcher, returns to discuss his book, Paranormal Technology, among other things. His book's the first book to... The book offers new techniques, answers questions, and provides experiments which will help bridge the gap between paranormal and science. David, welcome back to the program.
Hey, guys. Always fun to be here.
Yeah.
Well, it's nice to have you back.
Quite the regular guy.
It's like I never left.
Yeah, he's thinking, gee, didn't we just hang up from this? Oh, my God.
Deja vu.
Yeah. So tell us, let's reacquaint listeners with what you do and all that. If you can give them a brief background and focus of research and all that stuff.
Sure. I started in this, if you want to call it a field, back in 1976. It wasn't much of anything back then, but a lot of myths and, you know, suppositions. But we started out with some very antiquated military surplus equipment. And in spite of all that and the lack of technology or knowledge, made a few discoveries. And since that time, I've narrowed my field of specialist type of research into electronic voice phenomena. And as a byproduct of doing that, I have discovered a lot of very interesting things along the way. And today I'm probably consulted with, I probably get 100 emails a day just on EVP subject matter alone, and I try to do my best to answer folks who email me about it.
Well, you're a popular guy. If I had known you were getting 100 a day, I probably wouldn't have sent it, but I'm glad.
No. That's only for EVP.
Oh.
I'm getting roughly right about now. I went from about 60 emails a day to about 350.
And what to what do you owe this popularity increase?
The book, of course. When the book came out, it was like I didn't get any reaction from it for about 3 days, and then suddenly it was like someone opened up a can.
Well,
and everything came out. So that was a good sign. Get it into people's hands and in the right people's hands.
Well, tell us about the book. Tell us.
Well, the whole idea of the book was a couple of years ago, I was lamenting about the fact that no one had ever put together any kind of scientific guidebook for the paranormal investigator. you know, there are plenty of groups out there who were establishing protocols and all these different things, but I was sort of seeing the same kind of technical mistakes being made over and over again and then being perpetrated by new groups copying the groups or copying the TV shows or whatever that they were watching, and they were emulating the same old mistakes, and the field wasn't really going anywhere with it. And so I thought, book and take each piece of equipment, what it actually told you, and put the case, it would be great. And then I realized if it was ever going to happen, it would probably have to be me that did it. So I took a year out of my life and continued to do research and worked on the book part-time until I had it together. And it was a difficult task because every time I thought I was finished with it, I would make a discovery or something would happen that would cause me to have to revise a chapter here or there. And eventually I reached a point where I said, hey, you know what? Got to stop. Got to get it to the publisher. And it came out in August, and it's gotten a lot of really good reviews. It's going to be reviewed by the Psychical Research Society in England. They had it on the front page of their website for about a week. And I noticed that the UK sales jumped significantly, so I really appreciate them doing that. It's been very well received, and I'm getting a lot of personal email of people who are like saying, hey, this is great. I've read it now for the third time. Every time I read it, I'm picking up something new from it. And it's not just, you know, a book about the equipment, because I put it together to be kind of like a field manual so that you could use it as a training aid. You could use it, but it's also, I kind of trick people into learning physics along the way. And I do it in very lay terms, but I also include a higher level of explanation with it so that it's kind of pulling people into a greater knowledge base, whether they're aware of it or not. So I kind of have a little fun with the reader in doing that. But I have some experiments in there, and I include some theories, and I try to make it as pleasant to read as possible so that it's not just a dry book of a bunch of data.
Yeah, that's good.
So far I think I've done the job on it, because the feedback that I'm getting has been very positive, and like I say, I've had a lot of people say they're reading it several times. So,
well, that's good. You know, you got to get all that technical stuff out of it, so that's good.
Yeah, well, I promise not to use any math, but I did throw a little bit in. But I warn the reader ahead of time when it's coming up so that they can, like, skip through it if they want to.
So tell people where they can get it.
Oh, man, you can get it anywhere. It's on 6 continents, and for a while it was on the 7th, but the guy came back from Antarctica that had the one copy he took with him up there. But any online bookstore has it. You can go to your local bookstore. You can order it from there. You can go to my website, and it has a whole list of international links as well as national links. I mean, literally, it's available all over the world. I was amazed.
And there should be a picture of the cover on the show page if you're listening live, so you can click on that.
Click on the cover. It takes you to a links page, and whatever your favorite medium of purchase is. I will say Amazon has it on sale. It normally retails for $21.95. Amazon has it, I think, for $19.95.
And also tell everybody your website, too.
The website is www.spinvestigations.org.
So, since we last spoke, what kinds of exciting research or discoveries that will change humanity forever have you gotten into?
Well, I don't know about that. That'll probably happen after I'm gone and can't reap any reward from it. But my heirs will be the ones to benefit from any of that. But we have been playing around. Yeah, we have been playing around with the EMF triangulation device, which I have lovingly referred to as the wormhole detector. We've been making some refinements on that because one of the things that I discovered the last time we were out is that using the loop coils is really great because they're very sensitive. However, they are bidirectional. So if there's something behind the coil, the coil is also going to pick it up.
Is that what you wanted?
No. So what was happening is sometimes we would get interference from a local radio station or whatever from the backside of the coil. So
backside.
Yeah. So
coil's backside.
Yes, the coil's rump. So now what we're doing is I'm modifying a set of aluminum baby moon hubcaps to act as a parabolic ground behind it to shield the backside of the coil
cool.
to prevent that from happening. And I'm a man of many tricks for no money.
Nope.
So.
Necessity is the mother of invention, right, Dave?
That's exactly right. On my budget, hey, we use hot pans if we have to. And actually how I figured it out is I used pie pans, believe it or not, and clip leads to figure out that would work. So I want to do something that looks a little bit more professional than, you know, pie pans, you know, aluminum throwaway pie pan.
Yeah, put two of those together and throw it in the air and take a picture.
That's right, you know. And the duct tape is kind of hokey, you know, holding it on the coil.
But if you blur it, they'll never see it.
That's right. That's right. Make it move fast and shake the camera when you take the picture.
You've got it. Hoaxing 101.
That's right. So the concept worked out. So now I'm looking for a more cosmetic modification to do to it, so it doesn't look so ridiculous.
Go find some of those dish antenna or, you know, dish network or direct TV.
Well, I've got a couple of those, but I actually use those as antenna because I have a couple of amplifiers that I use and signal strength meters to where I can do a sweep for microwave radiation.
Interesting.
You know, do a horizontal sweep. And I've got a 500 meg dish and an 800 meg dish. And I use those just for, you know, finding any type of interference that might be in the environment around and trying to say, okay, let's be aware that this is there. And it's kind of a neat thing because I didn't realize just how much microwave is actually bombarding us on a daily basis. You know, we've got a pretty dense microwave field around us.
I imagine.
And it's low wattage and everything, but, you know, we're getting beamed with TV information from satellites all the time.
Slowly cooked.
Yeah, no wonder I'm going crazy.
Well, yeah, I was barely alive then.
What about cell towers? Do they dolt out the same sort of things?
For frequency, it's around 900 megs. It's between, depending on what kind of information, you've got 900 and you've got 700, depending on what it is. But again, too, that's relatively, you know, low power. So it's not really damaging, I don't think, unless you're right up against it in the long run. But it's still interference. It's noise floor.
It was like swimming in all kinds of electromagnetic, or being, not only are we being bombarded by man-made stuff, but who knows what kind of natural stuff's leaking through the atmosphere.
Well, that's the thing. It's kind of hard to, if you're not looking for it, it's kind of hard to eliminate those things from your mix. And, that's kind of one of the things I go into in the book a lot is how important it is to eliminate the things that are man-made or byproducts of man-made items that could lead to false positives in what you're doing, which is how we are easily debunked when we go to the scientific community to try to present something. And they always pull the chair out from under you and saying, oh, well, it's just simply this. And the whole idea is to try to head this stuff off at the beginning and eliminate it, or at least tag it and bag it so you know where it is, and be able to go right back at them and say, no, we know that we had this 900 megahertz signal here, here, and here, and this is the radiation pattern, and it really wasn't a factor, you know, interfering with what we were doing. You've got to be able to do that, and then it kind of takes the wind out of their sail, and then eventually someone looks at you kind of seriously and says, let me see that again, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And that's the point, you know. That's what you're trying to hope for, is to get them to seriously look at what you're trying to give them. So,
well, interesting. If you're listening to the live program and you have a question for David, don't hesitate to type it or call in on the call-in number. There is a question from Kathy in the chat room. What do you think about thermal imagers? Do you have an opinion?
Man, I have an opinion on everything. Thermal imagers, it depends on what you're trying to use it for. They're very useful tools for looking for living, breathing creatures if you're a crypto person. They're very helpful for finding drafts and temperature differentials along surfaces, but they're absolutely useless for trying to determine where a cold spot is in a room because they're specifically designed to ignore ambient temperature. They basically measure reflected temperature off of the surface. So, but used correctly, they're very useful tools. I think it's probably one of the best tools I've ever seen used in a crypto hunt looking for creatures because it definitely will find creatures in the woods, in the dark. So it's great for that.
Yeah, they are. They're cool.
What's their practical application? Remember, guys, I'm not the most technical person in the world. I'm just curious, what would be an industrial application for thermal imaging to see where you're having air conditioning leaks?
I tell you where they're best used. They're best used when you go into like an area that's using large motors and finding a bad bearing.
Oh, okay. All right.
Without tearing a motor apart or
because of the heat signature or something along those lines?
Exactly. Okay. A bad bearing will look like a star.
Mm-hmm.
We've used them on the railroads, too, as well, to check wheel bearings to make sure that they're not overheating or about to start a fire. You know, you can find a dry bearing that way. So they're useful for that. They're also useful for finding electronic components that are overheating. You go into a room, you've got 20 or 30 pieces of gear, you scan the room and you look and you can find, oh, hey, we got an amp or we've got something over here that's like running a lot hotter than the rest of them, you know, maybe we should look at it. So it's a good tool for anything that is temperature reactive or temperature sensitive, and it's also very good for determining whether you've got high levels of friction or any heat generating problem with equipment. And it's fast, it's quick, it's very little labor involved, and it is very very helpful in getting to the meat of a problem before it becomes catastrophic. So that's the real use for the tool.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
Let's talk about EVP tips. What are some tips that come to mind for you as an EVP researcher that you might pass along to other researchers to help them to be more proficient at it?
Well, I tell you, we've got a little setup, a portable setup now that's just really outstanding. And what we did was whatever your studio quality handheld digital recorder of choice is, what we have done is I found this little battery-operated two-channel mixer that's designed for a cameraman to carry for stereo audio on a remote shoot. And it's about the size of a little bit bigger than two decks of cards taped together. And you can powers off of a 9-volt battery, has phantom power. But what's neat about it is you can plug either two dynamic microphones in, or if you're looking for a comparative where you've got a clean signal and an EVP signal, you can put a condenser in one channel and a dynamic in the other, pan each one of them in opposite directions and pump them onto your recorder. And it's all self-contained. You can put it all on a little sling around your neck. It's very lightweight. You can take some earbuds and stick into your recorder, and you can attempt two-way communication.
So what's the name of this mixer, and is it available?
It's made by Rolls, and all you have to do is go to Google or whatever your favorite choice is for searching and type in Rolls battery-operated mixer.
Is it
several choices?
R-O-L-L-S?
R-O-L-L-S, battery-powered mixer. And you'll get a couple of choices, but the two-channel one is ideal.
That's cool.
It's very cheap right now. I think they're running around $99 if you search on them. And it's well worth the money. It's a low-noise, it's a broadcast-quality mixer. Runs off a 9-volt battery. So, great thing. And pair that with a couple of decent dynamic microphones or even a decent dynamic microphone and an inexpensive Behringer condenser microphone, and, man, you've got a great setup.
Okay, cool. So, barring that, what? In fact, there's a question this might tie into in the chat room. What's your favorite piece of equipment in terms of investigations?
Oh, man. I think if I could have one piece of equipment, it would be a handheld oscilloscope.
Really?
And the reason being is because you can do so many things with it just by adding a different sensor to the end of the wire coming out of it. Yeah, I mean, if I could only have one piece of equipment, I think that would tell me the most about a situation if I had an oscilloscope and a couple of sensors.
And what kind of sensors?
Well, I'd want an EMF sensor and probably a temperature sensor. And with those two things, I could probably get a lot. I mean, I wouldn't have a big body of evidence, but it'd be kind of hard to convince me that something weird wasn't going on, you know, if I had those two devices.
What about audio recorders?
Well, I'm sold on the Tascam DR7, and primary reason is I've been finding them on sale for as little as $99, and it originally sold for almost $400. And in some places, it's still selling for $400. But it's one of those items that, because of its popularity, particularly now because I've been recommending it for a year, a lot of places are discounting them and selling them to move numbers of them. And you can do an internet search and pick one up from anywhere from $99 to about $140 on a pretty regular basis.
Can you repeat the brand and model?
It's made by Tascam, which is world famous for making recording devices. The reel recorder. They used to make studio quality reel to reel 8 and 16 track recorders. Now they make a real fine digital recorder. And there's a lot of really fine digital recorders out there.
Do they make only one, or is there a certain model?
Oh, no. They have a whole bevy of different levels. I mean, they have a two channel one that actually allows you to overdub, and it's a pocket studio, which is pretty cool.
What's the name of it, so I can put it in the chat room? Tascam?
It's a Tascam DR-07.
DR-07.
Yeah. And we use the pocket studio version for a data logger, because you can log EMF information right on it. And then you can take that back to your lab or whatever and use your audio software to analyze the waveforms. Because as long as they're in the audio spectrum, they're going to be picked up and recorded just like audio will.
What do you think?
That's kind of a neat trick.
What do you think of the Zoom H2, I think it is?
Zooms are fine. I mean, anything that gives you low noise, low distortion, high quality, and that you can use an external mic with, it's a great, you know, whatever works. I mean, I just gave my preference because of competitive pricing and field performance. But I know a lot of people that use the Zoom, and they're very happy with it, and they get good results. So
yeah, I've heard good stuff about it.
Yeah.
What recorders should people avoid?
Those little pocket voice recorders like the Olympuses and the little Sony. They're bad recorders. It's just that they create a lot of artifacts because of the quality of the recorder. In other words, you'll get a lot of crap in your recordings that are byproducts of the actual recorder. It's designed for dictation, and as such, it's not really designed as a full-spectrum frequency recorder. And it's mono, and it's good for an entry-level investigator who doesn't have a lot of money, who needs to get experience, because you will capture EVPs with them. But when you get serious, you realize that you have to sometimes really fish at the noise floor for some of the EVPs that you get. And a lot of times, a better quality recorder makes that job a whole lot easier.
That's
and you'll
good.
Pick up things that cheaper recorders will distort. So, I mean, and you know, it's not like everything that you hear in the noise floor is going to be an EVP, because if you can't understand what it's saying, it's just an interesting noise signature. But with a better recorder, a lot of times you can differentiate from some of those blurred sounds to get a much crisper sound out of what you're trying to go after, and it's easier to get some intelligibility out of it. So, as you progress, you start to realize the limitations of your equipment, and you start adjusting accordingly. And the better equipment that you use, the better your results are going to be.
Well, let's talk about an EVP that I got that you commented on. And I talked about this on, I forget, I think I talked about on Informal Paranormal a few weeks ago or something. I've talked about it sometime, but it was an amazing thing. And let me just give a brief background to our listeners. I was at my computer. Duh, where else am I? I was at my computer here. It's been about, 6 weeks or so ago, something on that order.
Yeah.
And it was, I remember it was a Tuesday morning. It was 2 o'clock in the morning. I was working on an audio recording for one of my other sites. It was a 2-minute, about 45-second recording. And it was just an overview of the site. It's a metaphysics site. And so I had already recorded it. I had my script. I recorded it. And I was converting it. I was mastering it using Audacity. And I was playing around with the volumes, the levels of the music, and so on and so forth. And so I converted it to an MP3. Well, I wanted to convert it to a Flash file, an SWF file, for the website to play it easier.
Right.
And I had this little program I've used for several years. It's a great little program, and Web Audio Plus, and I've used it many times. So I'm converting it from MP3 to Flash, and I did it a couple of times, no problem. I adjusted the levels, converted it to an MP3 from Audacity, then took the MP3 and converted it to a Flash using this program. Well, I got an error, and it was, it was 2 o'clock in the morning. I'm trying to finish the thing up. I didn't pay a lot of attention to the error. I'd gotten another one on some other thing, and I'm thinking, okay, my computer needs to be, stroked or talked to nicely or something. And so I just blew through it. I should have paid attention, but I blew through it. But I happened to notice that the file was created.
Yeah.
As expected. So I said, okay, well, maybe it wasn't anything. So I clicked on it to play. Now, remember, the original recording was 2 minutes and 45 seconds long. I got a recording, and I wish I could play it for y'all. I haven't published it yet on Paranexus. Maybe I will. But I got this recording in this voice that almost sounded like more than one voice, but it just said, "What do you want?"
Yeah.
It was
very clear.
Oh, it was very clear. I don't know, it was more like, "What do you want?"
Yep.
Something on that order. Not as mean sounding, but it wasn't my voice. And the interesting thing is I'm thinking, WTF, that's what I'm thinking. What the hey? Where did this come from? I mean, from a 2-minute and 45-second recording down to about a second and a half. And the interesting thing about this was that two of those words were not even in my script. I did not even say them in my recording. And so I'm thinking, oh, cool, okay, I've got something going on here. So, I played, I went along with it, and I even started up Audacity again and trying to do some EVP work. Okay, the good question, what do you want? Of course, I had to spend a few minutes thinking, oh, it's a good question, what do you want? But, I did some EVP work, couldn't get anything. And I'm trying to figure out how in the world this could happen. So that's the background on it. I sent it to the most technical guy I know on this stuff. I sent it to Ingrid. I sent it to several people. And David, maybe you can kind of comment on what you, or at least the best plausible winning explanation, given our contest.
Well, there's actually only a few things that could cause it and that are normal. The one thing that could cause something like that would be a close proximity to a transmitter, an RF transmitter, that was strong enough to interfere with the sound card operation and have the sound card demodulate an audio snippet at the exact moment, which could cause an error and could conceivably create the message. But I do not believe that was the case of your environmental situation at the time.
Yeah, I don't either.
And the other option is a police radio very close to your proximity. But that really is pushing it, because we're talking about a 5-watt transmitter instead of a 100,000-watt transmitter.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's real iffy.
Mm-hmm.
And then that leaves us with, did something interfere with the software protocol? Did something mm-hmm. interfere with the signal path of the converted file as it was being saved as a data, you know, as a data file? I mean, there's just not a lot of things naturally that would put a voice. And I'll tell you something, I looked at that voice and I looked at your voice, and they're not the same. They're
voice.
Different signatures.
Yeah.
So it wasn't like you were disguising your voice and making the sound, because your voice has some very unique markers in it, and they weren't present in that voice.
That was
so
kind
either,
of you. I've been working on the sibilance, man.
And even the recording. I mean, if you look at just that segment where that voice is, that part of the file has a different background sound than the rest of the recording. Mm-hmm. It's altered. And it's altered in such a way as it's like a modulation almost is the only word I can think of to use, because it's kind of a flickering to it, you know. And there's a resonance to it that isn't present in your voice, and there's markers in it that are unique to that voice that are different from yours. So it wasn't like you disguised your voice and did it. It was
right.
A genuine, separate.
It was an anomaly for sure.
Yeah, and it was an anomaly. So that was the first thing that was quite interesting about it, is because I put it through all these tests, and you know, it came up with, you know, it didn't appear to be anything artificially generating it. It appeared just like it was a audio file. And that part of it was a natural audio file. The problem is there's no explanation for how it got there.
Yeah, that's what's puzzling the hell out of me. I mean, when you talk about police radios or even other radios, I mean, yeah, that sounds like a good plausible explanation. The problem that, with that is that, I mean,
well, the content doesn't really match up either.
Well,
why would someone say that into a radio?
Yeah, that's true. But I mean, I have done tons and tons of audio recording on the computer and otherwise
and
for
never
years.
Had this happen.
I've
right.
never had a police radio come over on any of my recordings.
Nor have
no
CD, I.
No FM,
right.
No nothing.
Nor
and,
have I.
And the interesting thing, this didn't happen while I was recording. It's not like I got an EVP while I was recording.
No, you were converting a file.
Yeah, it was in the file conversion. And I'm thinking, oh, my God, how could that possibly happen? Essentially.
And much as I hate to admit it, there's really no real natural explanation for what you got. And
I can't.
The only type of EVP.
You know, and there's, of course, my speculation, and this is just my own brainstorming, trying to think, where did this come from? I mean, the choices are not that many. I mean, it could have been an entity here. I don't have this kind of stuff happen to me very often at all. It could be, I don't know, could it be PK, you know, my own higher self or something? And could it be a guide? Could it be in some entity? And I don't know. I mean, the question, what do you want, came out of the blue.
Yeah.
It just phased me. I mean, my mind was the furthest it could be from anything paranormal or you know, EVP research or anything. I'm just trying to finish this recording. So basically,
yeah.
You're saying that if in fact it was an entity or whatever, it created this EMP spike, right, or EMF spike, which created the error on the computer.
Exactly. An EMF spike would have done that. The EMF spike would have had to have been in the audio spectrum. Now, here's something else. It may not have been an active entity at all. It may have been a time slip,
mm-hmm.
you know, something where you hit a time bump where it was something from the past, and it just ambiently had to happen at that exact moment, and all the conditions were right to cause it to have the effect that it had. I mean, there's a lot of things it could have been other than just some active entity or something speaking. It could have been other things. But even that, you know, that's pretty cool. I mean, when you think about it. And So the things that could have caused it make any sense of being the cause.
I'm with you.
Well, I think the thing that that's kind of neat about it is that you weren't expecting it.
Yeah.
Maybe that's the nature of the paranormal. Is that when you least expect it, that's what occurs.
Yeah. It always does, and it's very transitory in its effect. But see, that's another thing where I would question whether it was something that was self-generated because your mind wasn't even in that place.
Yeah.
And I mean, you know, one could arguably say that our minds are always in that place because of what we do, but believe it or not, there are times when we try to get as far away from it as possible. And you know, when those things are happening, you're purposefully not thinking about that stuff. You're trying to occupy yourself with something else, so your mind isn't even really running along those lines anyway. So about the consciousness and about the mind and about the subconsciousness, that's just, you know, we're making a speculation on that.
Sure.
But, you know, unusual, and I think it defies rational explanation.
Well, that's good for me because, you know, I've been scratching my head over it. And, you know, me, I try to answer things, naturally.
Well, I've got the same problem, you know, with that Morse code file that was sent to us. I mean, I've played it for a lot of different. Of a second apart and all this stuff. So, you know, and I'm thinking. Yeah, but there's parts of this file that would be very difficult to fake because whoever, if it was faked, they completely reproduced the effect of an RF carrier fading in and out due to distance.
All right, we're going to...
That's kind of hard to do.
Yeah. All right, we're getting some reports that our sound has gone to hell, and so here's what I'm going to do, folks. I'm going to put some music on, and we're going to reestablish the connection. So if you'll bear with us, you may have to refresh when we come back, but I'll post in the chat room too when to refresh, and we'll see if we can pick up this, do a little better on the sound. So just give us a few moments to try to fix this problem. We'll be right back.
Okay.
Well, Grant, you there?
I'm here.
Okay.
Hey, Dave, you blanked out for Stone.
Wait, Grant, could you? You dropped out a little bit. Say it again.
Storm now?
No, you're breaking up now. Try it again, Grant.
Testing. 1, 2, 3. Test.
It's not too bad, but let's see where we go with it.
All right.
Okay, I think everybody's listening to us anyway. So I'll stop the music. We went live when we came back on. Hey, everybody, we're back. Sorry, I thought we were muted, but it unmuted it. So you may have to refresh. I'm going to put that in the chat room.
Mm-hmm.
And then we'll pick up our conversation. Sorry about that. It just... You know, sometimes the Skype connection just is crappy.
Yeah.
And so hopefully that will be better. And if you're in the chat room listening to the live program, if you need some feedback, let me know if it's good or crappy or superb or whatever. All right, so yeah, go ahead and add anything else you'd like to add, David.
We were talking about that very troublesome Morse code file that seemed to be from a fellow named Frank who was going in, you know, ditching in the water. And the problem with the whole thing is that the more I've thought about it, the more I've thought that it had to have been created by a code machine. But you have to realize they were using automatic code senders back in the 40s. So it isn't too big of a stretch to think that someone may have been punching in the information to the code sender and the code sender was actually transmitting the code. So I don't think it was a hoax. Plus, the way that it got to the person who got it, it was left on their voicemail of their cell phone. And again, this is kind of hard to explain because there was no record of a telephone call to the cell phone to leave the message, and there was no record from the phone company of the message even being left on the voicemail.
And is it possible for when I hear of things like that, I wonder if there's like energy whirlpools or eddies or whatever that maybe that signal was a legitimate signal, like, you know, that came about, you know, 40, 50 years ago.
Yeah, that's the thing.
Got caught in the loop.
That's the thing. I mean, I think that's a very plausible possibility. Hello?
Yeah.
Yep, we're here.
Okay.
Skype's not always, but we're still here.
Yeah, no, I mean, that was the first thing that I started thinking about was what if it's just a historical event that, and this phone happened to pick up a time anomaly. You know, some type of time vortex occurred where this information was just intercepted. It's just the mechanism for how it got on the phone is still a mystery because there's so many modern technological things and it's not even the same frequencies. And you know what I'm saying? I mean, there's just a whole lot based on the information or the evidence trail. It pretty much got there by osmosis or something onto the voicemail.
That's so bizarre that it was picked up on a cell phone. That's so wild.
And the thing is the cell phone never rang. It was a brand new cell phone. She had just bought it, taken it out of the sealed manufacturer's packaging, called up, made sure everything was working, set it down and cooked dinner, and it was sitting down on the bar in the kitchen or whatever, and it never rang. Anything went off. And when she went back to it after dinner, she said, oh, man, somebody left me a message. I didn't even hear the phone ring. And she picked it up, and she listened to it, and she freaked out. And then she, of course, sent it to me so I could sit there and pull what little bit of my hair was left out trying to figure out how in the heck it happened, you know. But I've come to a conclusion. I believe it was a fraud. I don't believe it's a fake. I mean, there's just, I don't know too many people capable of pulling everything off that would be required to do that.
Because that's going to be a whole different frequency set.
Oh, yeah. And the thing is why would they do it to this person? This well, no. Just, you know, a typical middle-class family that, you know, isn't even involved in any kind of controversy of any kind.
They're certainly not going to relay the message, that's for sure.
Yeah, you know, it just doesn't make any sense. So the motivation for any kind of fraud isn't there.
Let me throw out something here. This is just a what if, and may not go anywhere. But, you know, these things seem to happen. I mean, Grant and several of us have talked about these before. These types of things seem to happen, and it's to nobody in particular, just somebody.
Average Joe.
Yeah. I mean, they'll see something, they'll experience something that seems to be legitimate, but yet you can't explain it. And
right.
And it really smacks of some kind of, I don't know, trickster or some whoever just trying to keep people guessing.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think?
Yeah, no, I mean, that's the nature of the paranormal. I mean, there's a certain trickster element. When stuff starts happening,
yeah.
You know, whatever that you don't have the camera is where stuff happens. You know, that's the nature of it, which,
yeah, like,
you know, makes
peek-a-boo.
Me think that there's
some bizarre case of peekaboo.
Yeah, it's like some kind of intelligence behind it, and it's having a good time at your expense, you know, that kind of thing. But, yeah, I mean, that's the nature of this business. I mean, when you go in there, you have to expect that sort of thing because that's exactly what, if you have any kind of activity, it's going to do stuff like that. And, yeah, I agree. You know, there is a certain trickster element to it.
And, so, Dave, I'm still fascinated with your wormholes. Tell us a little bit about what you've been doing with your research on the wormholes.
Well, it's kind of neat. It didn't start out as research for wormholes. It started out to try to pinpoint the emergence of EMF into the environment. One of the theories that I was developing was that this EMF that was creating EVP was literally appearing out of nowhere. And what I wanted to do was to see if it was possible to pinpoint the exact area of emergence where this was entering the environment to try to concentrate, you know, some instrumentation at that point to determine what exactly was going on, or to study the interface to figure out what was in play, or if it was possible to determine what may be in play. And what we did is, I put together these three of these interesting coil devices, which started their lives as television picture tube degaussers. And they were all exactly the same, same manufacturer, same impedance. Everything about them was exactly the same. So I figured, hey, I've got three great sensors here. And then the idea was is to take them, put them on long enough umbilicals that I could put them in a triangle shape in a large area or a room, and run them back to a low-noise high-gain preamp and then into a distribution amp, and then run each coil's output into a frequency counter and an oscilloscope and then into a data logger so that I could make a permanent record of what each sensor was doing and then look on the oscilloscopes and determine where the wave appearance was the strongest, and then attempt to readjust these sensors closer and closer until we could pinpoint an exact point of entry. And it worked. And we were able to concentrate all the rest of our gear at these points once they were established. And we found out that there was all kinds of other things going on at that area at the same time, things like gamma radiation bursts and dramatic increases in ion counts. Time slips were occurring. I mean, there was changes in atmospheric pressure, there were temperature shifts, there were humidity changes, and all in a very localized area, which defies, you know, weather. So the more we started to study it, the more we realized that something was literally affecting a very localized area of our environment, and whatever was doing that was associated with this emergence of EMF and for indicative of, you know, subatomic particle annihilations, and that was probably due to
okay, folks.
Skype gods are really angry with us tonight for some reason. I don't know why.
We fell through the wormhole.
Yep. Yep. We just returned from the ether.
Yes.
Well, the thing that's always that in itself is fascinating, and you know, when I think of wormholes, I think most of us think of, you know, like the science fiction wormholes. And,
right.
And most scientists, you know, I mean, it all works out well on Star Trek and whatever to go, or Stargate or whatever. But most scientists will tell you that wormholes, I think physicists, I think I can go out on a limb safely and say that they're a very short duration, and because of the laws of physics involved, just as quickly as they open up, they close as quickly. So,
yeah, it's, you know, but very maybe transitory. We had the longest duration that we were able to map was just under 5 minutes. And,
but that's
I think,
lifetime in comparison to what most physicists would probably say, isn't it?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, there's a lot of physicists who deny the existence of them in the first place, too. So, I mean, you know, there's nothing on it other than theoretical. So that's why I think this work's very important right now, because if we happen to find some kind of physical evidence that's indicative of it being warm, it would be huge. But the thing that we've noticed is, and I've developed a theory of what's actually going on. What I think happens is these wormholes are forming between two universes. And how they stabilize is by exotic matter in the throats that is picked up prior to the connection. In other words, between the two universes is this soup of exotic matter, and these wormholes are forming in that soup. And once they make the connection, the exotic matter begins to decay because of incompatibilities, and that's what's giving off that gamma radiation, is the annihilation of those exotic matter particles when they come into contact with our own. And eventually the level of exotic matter depletes to the point where it collapses. However, there's nothing stopping it from reforming in almost the exact same place over and over again once it regains its stability and reconnects. Of course, you know, it could take 10 minutes, 10 days, 10 years. Who knows how time travels in that soup? And it may be on a regular recurring basis, but we have no reference in order to do that from our point of view.
So what does this all mean for the paranormal? What are the implications?
Well, it means to me that these things may not be paranormal at all. They may be parinormal, or they may be normal and we just don't understand what's going on with it. In other words, let's take a hypothetical journey here, just to make a point.
Yeah.
What if when we die, our consciousness, the electronic impulses that are inside of our body, which is energy, what if it leaves our body and radiates it out, maintaining itself as energy, and what if it maintains its unity and its consciousness and shifts into a higher frequency of resonance and goes to a parallel universe or an adjacent universe. In near-death experiences, mm-hmm. the common theme is that a tunnel appears with a bright light at the other end and they travel down the tunnel and there's all their dead loved ones. Well, what if, let's just say, for argument's sake, that when we die, we become a being of pure energy and we travel through this wormhole to this adjacent universe, which is based on energy and not matter. There would be nothing to prevent that wormhole from reconnecting where we left, you know, where the point, physical point in this existence where we left from. And it may reconnect over and over again infinitely, which may explain why battlefields are so active. You know, maybe there are multiple wormholes manifesting themselves in and out constantly at a battlefield, which allows all sorts of stuff to happen. But
that's really interesting.
It may be an interaction between this existence and the next one, in other words. So that's the implication to me.
That's fascinating.
You know, and those sound reasonable. You know, it sounds plausible.
It's probable. That's the thing. It's probable. It's just not, we don't know how probable it is.
Yeah.
But it's the closest thing that makes any sense in science,
yeah.
other than accepting everything at so something happens to it.
Right.
The big question is, do we maintain our consciousness?
The
and there's a lot of anecdotal evidence that suggests that we do, just from reports and experiences that have been had. So it's not a far stretch, and I think it bears serious research.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, that's always been the big question, you know. Yes, the energy that is us has to go somewhere. Does
sure.
it remain coherent? You know, does that consciousness remain coherent? Does it remain distinctively us?
Right. An entanglement.
So interesting.
Yeah, if we believe in entanglement, we would have to accept that it does. Because if our consciousness is quantumly entangled, then it wouldn't disintegrate. You know, it would maintain its totality.
Well, we had Dr. Raymond Moody on here a few weeks ago, and
interesting fellow.
Yeah, great guy, and
yeah.
also became a consultant for Paranexus. And you know, the probably his two books, you know, Life After Life, and then the other one on shared, his most recent one on shared death experiences, you know, I think that really moved me over the hump on on things, because now we have these cases of different people from all beliefs and parts of the world really explaining or describing a similar process.
Yep.
And especially with the shared death experiences where loved ones in the hospital room, you know, they all share in this life review and part of the tunnel thing, or you know, or the path or whatever,
because
it is.
Because they're close enough to be within the effect of the throat.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're in that threshold of the throat, so they've got a foot in both worlds.
So that would be the wormhole of sorts that opens up on that.
Yeah, you know, the thing that's, what I was going to say, fellas, the thing that's so interesting about that is that, you know, and we've discussed this before, and we discussed it when Dr. Moody was here, is that at the point of death, you know, the body is shutting down, and you would think that instead of producing, you know, from the, and I'm talking about the near-death accounts, right, that rather than a mind being clear at that point, you would think it would be just the opposite. It would be very confused because various chemical reactions and chemical imbalances. And yet, you know, there have been people that have flatlined and have come back and during that time that they flatlined and can describe things that were happening in the operating room and operating theater that, you know, people really can't but what I find so interesting about that is it's a pretty decent case for the fact in some ways that consciousness survives. Because consciousness, how could you be that clear? And I mean, sort of things, so fascinating stuff.
Oh, and Dale just reminded me of the title. It's Glimpses of Eternity. That's Dr. Moody's latest book.
Yes.
So, you know, we're coming up on the last couple of minutes or so. David, you know, remind people of your book and where they can get it. Website real quick.
Yeah. No, the book is Paranormal Technology, Understanding the Science of Ghost Hunting. And you can Google my name and paranormal and find it.
Really. Give your website again.
It's www.spinvestigations.org. And you just click on the picture of the book.
Sounds good. And just as by way of letting people know what's coming up next week, we have... let's see, what is next week? Psychic Perspective, and it's going to be hosted by Lori Del Rio. She's a Paranexus member and a psychic medium, and we're going to be talking about using psychics on investigations. I'm going to be with Lori next week, but I'm also going to be in Virginia visiting John Rossi and visiting Jordan Springs and seeing Sharon West and also taking part in the Sweat Lodge, so that ought to be an enlightening experience, but I will be on the air next Thursday. Don't forget Informal Paranormal this Sunday night at 10 with John Rossi and Mike Jones, and I believe they're having Robert Graves as their guest this week. So tune in 10 p.m. Eastern on this Sunday. David, thanks so much for joining us tonight. We really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Always a pleasure having you, Dave.
And thanks for being part of Paranexus, and we appreciate everybody listening. If you're a Paranexus member, thank you so much. If you're not, please visit us at paranexus.org. Paranexus
and join.
Yeah. And you can interact with David and others as well. Have a great night, everybody. Take care.
Bye-bye.